Today's show is sponsored by Talkspace, the online therapy company. For a fraction of the price of traditional therapy, you can pick an experienced, licensed therapist you relate to and feel comfortable with. Each and every therapist has at least a master's degree and has completed over 3,000 hours of supervised work. To match with your perfect therapist, go to Talkspace.com/boom. And to show your support for this podcast, use code BOOM to get $30 off your first month. That's BOOM, Talkspace.com/boom, B-O-O-M.
Today's show is sponsored by SeatGeek, the smartest way to buy and sell tickets. Use the promo code LOHEAT, and SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your very first ticket purchase. Now, on with the show.
You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Welcome to Locked On Heat, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. My name is Wes Goldberg. I'm the editor at allyoucanheat.com, and with me on the other line, a man of many bylines, it's David Ramil. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great, man. This is a great show that I'm really looking forward to doing, and as always, looking forward to talking Heat basketball with you.
We've got a great show in store for you guys today. We're gonna continue our summer series on the top players at each position. We're going to do small forward today. We've done point guard and shooting guard already, so go back and listen to those. But first, we're going to start with a new segment that we're calling the Heat Check, where we cover some of the little more interesting tidbits going on with the Heat.
Sports Illustrated's Ben Golliver actually reported that Justice Winslow is a potential option to fill in for the U.S. men's Olympic basketball team in 2020. He broke down some of the reasons why he thinks Winslow, who will be 24 at the time, might be a good option. Do you see Winslow as a prospective option for U.S. men's basketball?
I love Gulliver's take on that, that he talked about a lot of the defense-first guys that have been on Team USA lately, and Andre Iguodala, Jimmy Butler, those kind of guys, and that Winslow by age 24 might fit that mold, particularly if he improves his jump shot in the next 4 years, which we assume he will, and even our buddy Matt Moore on the podcast when we had him on just a few weeks ago said that he is totally in on Justice Winslow and thinks that that jump shot is correctable and fixable. So if that's the case, I think Winslow would be a fantastic addition and would add something that this team didn't have and some hustle and some defense-first mentality.
I think with Greg Popovich taking over the team, I think he's more likely to promote guys who are role players, guys that can do little things, glue guys. And while, yeah, Winslow's offensive development is clearly a big factor, I think having a guy who we expect to be a major playmaker next season, somebody who can facilitate on offense and can do what he already does defensively, should be a good fit for this team. So I do like his option. I do like him as a potential option to fill in and bring back the gold in 2020.
My boy Chandler Parsons said in response to a Twitter question that he would be open to playing for a Florida team, the Magic or the Heat. Are you in or out on Chandler Parsons playing for the Heat one day?
Well, I think he's a good option to fill in at power forward if Chris Bosh isn't available next season or beyond. It's a little bizarre. I'm not sure that if I was a Grizzlies fan, I'd like Parsons commenting on an upcoming team or upcoming contract, considering he just signed a rather lucrative one to come to Memphis. But as a basketball player, if we're looking at him as from just an on-court perspective, Parsons to the Heat makes a lot of sense.
I love it. I mean, I've always been a huge Chandler Parsons fan. I think his ability to handle the pick and roll on the wing and as a ball handler is really valuable. I think if this team kind of keeps taking this form down the line with guys like Goran Dragic and Josh Richardson and Justice Winslow, adding a guy like Chandler Parsons, particularly if Chris Bosh is no longer with the organization at that point, whenever this may happen, that gives them four legitimate ball handlers on the perimeter, which is where the NBA is trending. And I love the idea. He could space the floor. He's a good defender. He's a style expertise, so that always fits in South Beach. I need some more Chandler Parsons in my life, and I'd welcome him to the Heat.
Don't we all? Speaking of Chris Bosh, Miami Herald's Barry Jackson reporting that conversations, not with whom, but he says they're continuing regarding potential use of blood thinners that could be out of Bosh's system by game time. He's not quite sure whether or not the Heat are okay with that approach. Do you think it's a good idea for Bosh to be taking blood thinners?
I'm no doctor, but if...
You play one on TV, though.
That's true. And on podcasts. And you know, it sounds like this thing would be out of his system within by game time, as long as he takes it at the right time. And before this report, Barry Jackson had another report talking about where he interviewed doctors, and a lot of them kind of said that they would be willing to, but that, you know, they're not necessarily NBA doctors, but that they think that this would work as long as the medicine's out of his system. There shouldn't be any worries. I hesitate because it's such a dangerous and scary thing, and again, I don't really know what the hell it is I'm talking about right now. But if all the doctors are signing off on it and Chris Bosh feels good with it, I think we got to get this guy on the court.
Yeah, I'm just not really kosher with the whole kind of, you know, mysterious attack approach that the Heat and you know, even Jackson to some extent has reported on these things. You know, neither the team or the player has been very vocal about it, and I know that there's nothing really actual to report, and until he's either on the floor or completely off of it. To me, I still think that this is just another one thing to prolong his career here in Miami, but that ultimately he's just going to wind up retiring before his time.
So we're going to get into our top five small forwards in Miami Heat history, but before we get to that, we got a live read for SeatGeek. Buying tickets online for sports and concerts has been a confusing process for a long time, but it's always been hard to find the best deal for that game or show that you want to go to. And none of those older ticket sites want to change that, but SeatGeek is different. They've come along and created an amazing app and website that makes it easier than ever for fans to buy and sell tickets. SeatGeek's the only site I use now for tickets. I used it last season for Heat Warriors tickets for me and my girlfriend. We lost, but the seats were good. And I got a great deal on Chance the Rapper tickets for October at the Greek Theater, which I'm super stoked for. Everything about SeatGeek is designed to make life easier for sports and music fans. SeatGeek does all the price comparison for you by searching multiple ticket sites and ensuring that you get the best deal possible. SeatGeek does all the work, and you save time and money. SeatGeek wants to help you get the most bang for your buck. That's why every ticket on SeatGeek is given a grade based on value. You'll immediately see any underpriced seats and be able to find the best deals that fit your budget. Best of all, our listeners get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. To get your $20 rebate on tickets, download the SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab and click add a promo code, enter the promo code LOHEAT, and SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your very first ticket purchase. Download the SeatGeek app and enter the promo code LOHEAT today. Okay, let's get into our top five small forwards all time. So we did point guards. We did shooting guards.
Mm-hmm.
We're going into small forwards. This one, we were texting earlier, was a little bit more challenging. I mean, with point guards, you don't have that many really good ones. So for the most part, you know, we knew the universe that we were choosing from. It was pretty limited.
Yeah,
for shooting guard, I mean, Dwayne Wade was clearly number one, and everything fell into place after this. Small forward, there's actually been a lot of good small forwards in Heat history.
It was more towards the latter part of that list, the five or four option, that I think were the most difficult to pick, because you're right, there have been a lot of great small forwards. And even if not necessarily great, great with his team, or fit like really, really good roles on this team. A lot of really decent role players that helped, you know, the Heat, you know, kind of establish that small forward position from the Pat Riley era and even before that, and even continuing into the Spoelstra days. I think there have just been a lot of good players to hold down that position. So I'm really curious to see who you have in your top five.
I have a feeling that ours are going to be really different.
Hmm.
I do. But I could be
wrong. Let's get into it.
I don't know. All right. You want to start with your number five?
Sure. Actually, at number five, I've got a name that should be very familiar to Heat fans. I've got Luol Deng, who just recently signed with the Los Angeles Lakers.
I guess ours aren't going to be that different. That's who I have at number five.
Well, look, I mean, I think it makes a whole hell of a lot of sense just based on, you know, his impact over the last 2 years. I think a lot of Heat fans, and maybe deservedly, have criticized him for his on-court play. He was inconsistent at times, but from the moment that Pat Riley declared him to be one of the most important signings in Heat history, I think we understood that at the time it was kind of being hyperbolic statement. But the reality is that it signified a major step for Miami in being able to remain competitive following the departure of LeBron James to Cleveland. And I think that's the biggest thing that you will remember Luol Deng for, that he was willing and able to step into some really, really, really big shoes that had been vacated by James. And he did a fairly good job. Now, there have been moments, as I'm sure a lot of Heat fans will remember, worth criticizing Deng Ford. There were times where he scored 23 points on one game and then score six the next. And I think that inconsistency is going to be there, has always been there as part of Deng's career. When he was more athletic and younger, it was something that he could play off a little bit. But I think, you know, we saw a lot of that. I think that's why a lot of Heat fans were disappointed in Deng's addition to the team. But he was really consistent. He was really, he was really productive and versatile. And I think we saw a lot of that when he was able to slide into the power forward position last season and to help take over the spot after Chris Bosh had gone down with another injury to keep him out for the rest of the season. So I think that, plus his performance in the playoffs last season, particularly in the opening round series against the Charlotte Hornets, helps leave a lasting legacy that Deng did a really good job here in Miami.
And just the whole responsibility of having to step in, not only for the in the shoes of LeBron James, right?
Sure.
He also did it for Chris Bosh. When Chris Bosh went down, as you mentioned, he slid over to the power forward position. I mean, who in Miami history has had to follow up LeBron and then Chris Bosh, like the likes of those guys? I mean,
right.
Two of the five best players that ever played in a Heat uniform, you know? And Deng came in, did the best he could to replace Bosh, or to replace LeBron, and then was basically asked to go play a stretch four position, which he never really played in the NBA, but
right.
He seemed totally comfortable with. And, you know, as much as Chris Bosh being out for the second half of last season hurt, Luol Deng stepping into the four position really, really helped Miami and to put a bandage over the loss of Chris Bosh and make them not feel it nearly as bad as what they would have felt if Deng wasn't on this team. If Josh McRoberts was forced to play the starting power forward spot, there's no way that he'd make the playoffs last season, I don't think. And you know, for Deng to be able to do all that in such a short amount of time, asked to do so much, I think his impact was huge.
Yeah, I just wrote about it in a piece today for today's Fast Break about his potential fit with the Lakers. And one of the things that I wrote about was how his role changed, not just from position to position, but from basically being a cutter and slasher through his early days in Chicago to being more of a standstill three-point shooter. And after his first season, it was one that he kind of grumbled about, that he didn't really feel comfortable in that role because it had never been asked of him to do something like that when he was in Chicago or, you know, for that half a season in Cleveland. And then what did he respond? How did he respond? He wound up taking more three-pointers last year than he ever had at any point in his career. So for somebody who didn't like the role of a three-point shooter, he was willing to do it. He made the transition. He knocked him down at a 35% rate over the 2 years that he was here. So I think he's proven that he's a quality shooter. And he still had some of that athletic ability to find spots to get easy shots at the rim. And you're right. I'm able to step into those two, huge, huge vacancies by either James or Bosh. I think certainly puts him in my top five. And I think a lot of Heat fans will probably agree.
At this point, yeah. And then Luol Deng went and got paid after he had a little bit of a career renaissance.
He sure did.
All right, moving on to number four. I've got Shane Battier.
Nice.
Unlocked a lot of the Miami Heat small ball stuff that they wanted to do during that Big Three era. He wasn't there the first year. The Heat signed him the second year. That was their big free agent acquisition. And after that, everything changed for LeBron, for Dwayne Wade, for Chris Bosh. Everything changed after that. They went on to beat the Thunder in the first finals. I think his biggest impact was that of helping LeBron reach his peak. With Battier involved, he could cover and he could defend opposing power forwards. He could let LeBron move around in these interchangeable forward positions that Eric Spoelstra introduced.
Yep.
And basically just let LeBron be LeBron. I mean, all of a sudden, LeBron didn't have to go defend the best power forward on the other team or the best perimeter player on the other team, and he could be more free to become the super, uber-efficient scorer that he eventually became. And so, you look at Shane Battier's stats on Basketball Reference or something, and it's not really there for his Heat tenure.
Right.
But, I mean, he just did all the little things as far as defending at a high level and consistently, making hustle plays, diving for loose balls, taking charges. I mean, if there was a Little Things Hall of Fame, Shane Battier is first ballot. So
yeah,
he won two titles in Miami and went to three of them. So absolutely,
yeah,
four for me.
I mean, great role player here in Miami. And I'll never forget when he announced his signing or his decision to sign with Miami right after the lockout had ended or right as it was about to end. And he sent out, I think, either a tweet or some kind of news bulletin saying, quoting Jimmy Buffett, if I'm not mistaken, I think from a song, Margaritaville. You know, it really let us know what kind of a person and, you know, what kind of a player Shane Battier was. And I think a lot of people kind of had some, I don't know, maybe disrespect necessarily, but I think being one of the quote unquote pretty boys of Duke that a lot of people hate around the country, the fact that Miami was still very much reviled around the country that had just lost the finals to Dallas. And I think a lot of people across the country were happy with that because they saw the dark side of Miami after LeBron and his decision and the coming together of the team. We're seeing a little bit of that this year with Golden State and Kevin Durant. And so I think for him to come here and be willing to accept a lesser role at that point in his career, because he had been a winner at every level. He won in college, he won at the high school level, and he just, you know, a title had eluded him in his career with Memphis and Houston. But what I always remember about Shane was the fact that he was part of two of the longest winning streaks in NBA history. To be part of our 27-game win streak here in Miami, and then also part of a 22-gamer with the Rockets, I mean, that shows that he's always been a committed winner, that he does whatever is necessary, and he certainly fit a great role here in Miami. So he was a great player, fun to watch, and you're right that he allowed everybody else on the team to play to their strengths while he was doing all the little things that allowed that.
Was he your number four?
No, unfortunately not. So when I looked at the number four spot, and Shane Battier is great, I looked at the guy who first fit that role in Miami, the first prototypical 3-and-D guy, and for me, that guy was Keith Askins. You know, he spent a 9-year career all with Miami. One of the things that I really loved about Askins was that he was an undrafted guy. And if you look at Basketball Reference and you see his transactions, you know, line, it's two entries: picked up by Miami, waived by Miami 9 years later. That's it. Not drafted, not traded, nowhere else. He spent his whole career here doing all the little things. And to me, one of the things that really cemented his place on our top five list was the fact that he was able to withstand the transition from pre-Riley to post-Riley. That Pat Riley, a guy who was emphasizing defense, versatility, and everything else, saw so much in Askins that he was willing to keep him here, not just for a season or two, but for 9 years. I mean, that's an impressive thing. And that's not to understate what he did. I mean, he played in 486 games, started in just 80 of them. And then you do look at his career averages, they're pretty low, just 3.8 points, 2.9 rebounds, and under a rebound, I mean, under an assist or steal per game. But he was a really, really good shooter, 35.5% for his career. At 6'7 and 200 pounds, he was the prototype 3-and-D guy, and he was the guy who really established that role for Miami. We'll talk about other small forwards that came in Miami history, but I think, you know, Askins was the guy who really set a template for guys like Bruce Bowen, and Shane Battier and others that really kind of fit that mold as what Riley was looking for, a guy who could knock down those three-pointers and still guard perimeter players. And so when I looked at Askins' numbers, you know, he had a best year in 95-96, Riley's first, and he hit almost 42% from downtown. I mean, that's really impressive stuff. And he was just a consummate professional here. You know, really great to watch him come off the bench and be a factor, and then to eventually be rewarded with a well-earned coaching position. I think he's currently with the Sky Force, but he's part of the organization. He's a Heat lifer before Udonis Haslem, before Dwayne Wade. This is a guy who was committed to this team, the only team he's ever known. So I had to include him. If you're looking at Haslem as one of those guys that embodies the Heat spirit, that was embodied by Askins well before Haslem joined the team.
Yeah. Askins is a director of college and pro scouting now. And I mean, you're right. I mean, I was going to say, I mean, the comparison to Haslem is a good one, because Askins in so many ways is like the first Heat lifer, you know, guy that start, you know, typical, you know, Heat lifer where maybe not drafted very high, undrafted, in fact, spends his whole career in Miami, and then afterwards is just immediately brought into the organization. He was on the coaching staff for a long time. Now he's in the scouting department, and just, you know, he's got a gig for life basically with the Heat. You know, maybe when Eric Spoelstra did the big shakeup to his coaching staff in 2013, you know, Askins didn't get fired. You know, that's not how it works in Miami. He got transitioned to a new role, maybe where now it better suits his strengths to go scout players now. But it's you know, the Heat lifer Mount Rushmore has to have Keith Askins on it.
I think that's a good point.
So I love Keith Askins. He didn't make my top five, but he was just because the stats weren't necessarily there.
Sure, no, I get it.
I'm totally into having him up there.
Yeah, and I always like one particular moment. I don't know if you remember it from a few years ago when Ron Artest at the time, before he became Meta World Peace, he kind of went to the sideline and he shoves a player. I can't remember. I want to say he shoved Caron Butler to the ground, and it was right in front of the Heat bench, and Riley didn't he didn't appreciate that too much. Maybe it wasn't Caron Butler, because I think Riley was coaching at the time, so I can't remember exactly when it was, but Riley was coaching at the time, and he kind of got into it with Artest a little bit. And, you know, at that point, this was before he had joined the Lakers, when he was a notable loose cannon. I think it was before the Palace at the Malice and everything else, but Ron Artest, being, you know, 6'8", weighing 260 pounds of solid muscle, he's a guy you don't want to get, you know, into a fight with. And Riley, to his credit, being that's connected to the tough guy that he's always been, didn't back down. But Askins, from two rows behind the coaching bench, threw his clipboard down to the ground, hopped over two rows of chairs, and got into our test, basically saying something not fit for our podcast and telling our test to get the hell out of there. That was, to me,
for our podcast, that's amazing. He must have some real sailor language there.
It's colorful. I'll leave it at that.
I love having Askins on the top five. I'm glad you have him there. All right. I've got number four. I've got number three. I've got Jamal Mashburn.
Sure. That was an obvious choice, I think, and a good one.
I think that, you know, I think with the point guard and shooting guard rankings, we talked about guys from that era, the mid to late 90s, quite a bit, because that's really the first stretch of, you know, the Heat becoming the Heat, you know. And Jamal Mashburn, we talk about guys like Tim Hardaway and Alonzo Mourning, who we'll get to on this when we do centers later on. Jamal Mashburn was like that third member of the big three for about for those three full seasons that he spent in Miami between the 96-97 to the 99-2000 season. And he was the top three scorer in each of those seasons.
Yes.
You know, he was the third scorer behind Zoe and Tim Hardaway in each of those seasons. So kind of played the Chris Bosh to, you know, Zoe's and Hardaway. So, I mean, he's just one of those guys that might have even been better today, in today's NBA. I mean, he was a long 6'8", 240. I mean, I looked up his height because he always seemed taller to me. Am I wrong there?
I think I hate to kind of say this, but I think he had like an oddly shaped, almost like conical shaped head. And I think it kind of gave that the idea that he might have been a little taller.
I always remember his release was pretty high. I just, like, yes, he just seemed long.
But he was also thick, too. At 6'8", he was 240 pounds. Yeah. He was built really thick, particularly in the lower body. I remember always having, like, really sturdy-looking legs and stuff like that. He was just so versatile.
And in his final season, the 99-2000 season, he shot 40% on threes at 3.7 threes per game.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like, he could have gotten paid $18 million a season if he just came off that year this offseason.
Absolutely. And I think that's part of the problem with Mash and how Heat fans view him, is that you made a great point about him being the third guy here. And I think that was like evidence of that Miami needed a big three, because I think at that point in time they were battling Chicago for supremacy of the Eastern Conference, and they needed a third guy who could counteract Rodman or Tony Kukoc coming off Chicago's bench. You know, they needed somebody like that who was going to be an adequate third scorer. And Mashburn came off a disappointing stint in Dallas where he kept fighting with Jason Jackson and Jason Kidd as well. So, you know, they had the three J's there, and Mashburn was supposed to be part of that trio that was going to lead that team to success. But they kept fighting. They kept squabbling. There was a lot of turmoil there in that locker room. And so they unloaded him basically for virtually nothing. and Miami was able to add a guy who was very versatile, a hell of a scorer, not a bad defender either. I think over a steal per game in his 3.5 seasons with Miami. So a really good, versatile player. But I think part of the problem is that, one, I think a lot of people look at him that he could have been better. He could have been, as you mentioned, an all-time great, I think. He could have been a guy who was so good from outside, capable of finishing at the rim with ease, a good rebounder, a good, a passer, just a very good overall player who could have been a really, really great one, and he just never reached that plateau. He did enjoy all-star success after he was traded to the Charlotte Hornets for Eddie Jones, but further compounding his career here, I think, is how a lot of people remember his last play in Miami. And I don't know how much you know about it. His last play here in Miami was Game 7 against the New York Knicks in the 2000 playoffs. And, I hadn't actually seen it since that actually happened in 2000. And kind of weird to look back at it because, you see everything playing out. And I saw a YouTube video. And he's actually not that bad. Everybody remembers him dishing it off to Weatherspoon. But he's actually not that bad. He actually got the ball with very little time left. And it was actually Weatherspoon who should have thrown it back out to Mashburn.
Yeah, I mean, passing up that shot is one of those, it's one of those infamous moments like, what are you doing? And, it's almost, I always felt that, when LeBron was, notorious for passing off shots. I don't know, if it was consciously, reminiscent of that, but I always felt like Heat fans, at least subconsciously, hate just the idea of passing up shots, especially at the end of games, just because of that Mashburn moment.
But it wasn't – you got to look back at the video, though, because – I'm sorry.
I had a long time.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that a lot of people think about or they remember it very negatively, but the reality was that – a lot had happened there. He actually had been the guy to force – Miami was down one. He was the guy who forced the steal in the first place as I think Chris Childs was driving to the hoop, and he was able to shag off a little bit. He was guarding Latrell Sprewell, who was at the top of the key, and Mashburn just sags off enough where he can disrupt Childs, who was driving to the hoop. He forces the steal, and then on the other end – they throw it into Zoe, who was double-teamed at the time, and then he throws it back out, and it's just the play is a discombobulated mess. They actually had to take a timeout with 13 seconds left. It was a real mess, and he gets the ball with very little time. I look back at it now, and at the time, everybody's thinking to yourself, Mashburn's that guy. He needs to be the guy who's taking charge. He actually got double-teamed. So he made the right play in dishing it off to Weatherspoon. But then Weatherspoon puts it down on the ground and it has this complete, he just doesn't know what to do with it. He wasn't expecting the ball in his hands. And so he should have actually dished it back to a wide open Mashburn who had been open now from about 20 feet, from the elbow. And instead time ran out and everybody remembers Mashburn for having failed Miami in that last moment of the game.
Yeah, the narrative of his third bananas almost takes over and kind of revises the way we kind of look back on that moment, I think. And now I'm interested. I'm going to go back and watch that because I think, like most Heat fans, you remember you just have this image in your head of Mashburn just being and just passing it off.
Right.
But, just kind of going along with that, though, when we talk about Mashburn, what he could have been, I mean, he could have been higher on this list. But maybe. But, his playoff performance was never really up to par for the Heat. I mean, I look back at his per-game stats for his three full seasons. He averaged about 15, 15, and 17 points per game in those three seasons. But that dropped in those to 10 points, 6 points, and then back up to 10 points in those playoffs for each of those seasons. So it was basically, 5 points less at least each year. And that's a huge drop off, especially for somebody who's a top three player on your team. You just can't have that. I don't want to fully blame Mashburn for all of that because in general the Heat were a little bit of a mess during the playoffs those years. Yeah. So it's not fair. But just to kind of wrap up this Mashburn conversation, I remember watching those Heat teams in the late '90s and just thinking every time Mashburn shot it, I thought it was going in. And that was just like my memory of MASH, which is like, it's going up. I feel like that it's going in. And I just, you know, to me, that's kind of the legacy that I have, just a really, really good shooter that probably could have, and now I just kind of like looking back on this list, probably could have been like a really, really good stretch four in today's NBA. And it just makes me appreciate MASH a little bit more looking back on him now.
Yeah, before we go into our next two, I think pretty obvious choices for most Heat fans. Mm-hmm. Kind of, I was thinking maybe we'd go over some of the guys that were left off the list. It was hard for me to leave Shane off because of all the reasons you mentioned, and he's certainly a worthy choice. I think Bruce Bowen is one of those guys that you don't realize what an impact he had, but I think a lot of people remember him from battling Kobe and the Lakers during his tenure with San Antonio as a lifetime, you know, a long tenured Spur. But the fact that he got his career start here after having struggled through, you know, trying to make it in Philadelphia, and then Riley gave him a chance, as he often does, found a diamond in the rough, and he wound up being another one of those guys that kind of fit that same prototype that Askins had left off. You know, Mike Miller was another guy who came in here, took less money, fit a great role here, and you know, there have been a number of good guys, and then one that was particularly difficult for me, Caron Butler. I know you had a chance to talk to him this past season, and he's one of those guys. I think looking at Heat history, I think it was the fact that, you know, after the turmoil of the Zoe era finally came to an end, and you know, the kidney disease had kind of had him on and off the court for two seasons, he finally chose to go to New Jersey as a free agent. You know, Caron Butler was the future of the franchise. And I'll never forget that draft day where he slid to 10th after a very good career at UConn. And there he is crying in the green room, the waiting room there, because he just never expected him to get to this point after all the turbulence and turmoil of his early young life. And you know, I think a lot of Heat fans really wanted Caron to succeed. And unfortunately, it was just that first season was not a very good one. It was a rebuilding team. You know, Zoe was gone, Hardaway was gone, and Butler was the de facto leader, unfortunately, and along with Brian Grant, who had gone through some injury issues himself, and Eddie Jones. And then, you know, fortunately for Butler, he was there for that great 2003-04 season, and he was a good but not vital part of that, I think, because, you know, by that point, the team had shifted clearly into belonging to Dwayne Wade. You also had Eddie Jones, who was still capable as a shooter, and Lamar Odom, who was so versatile and did so many things very well. By that point, it became obvious that Butler was more of a role player who just went on to have success elsewhere. He got traded to the Lakers for Shaquille O'Neal, but had good years and, you know, so many different teams. He played for the Clippers, played for the Mavericks, and I think with the Wizards is when he probably had his most successful seasons.
You know, I talked with Butler last season, like you said, and the thing about Caron is that every time he goes somewhere, he leaves an impact, and that was kind of what the crux of my story was about. And even after, and I talked to him during the Kings Heat game, and even after that game, you mentioned how like guys like Haslam and Dwayne Wade didn't spend a lot of time with, like, as far as years over their career, they only spent a couple seasons with Caron, just one season with Caron Butler. But even to this day, just from last season, they went immediately after the game and sought out Caron Butler and had a very, very long conversation and were very, very close and hugging and high-fiving and laughing and just having a great time. And you just – that doesn't – for all of the turnover in the NBA that happens season to season,
right,
to have, you know, 13 years after the one season they played together, to have that sort of bond
– right,
speaks volumes about the player. Not to get too much on Caron Butler, but I was with you. I wanted so badly to find a reason to put him in my top five, but you just couldn't because his tenure wasn't very successful. You know, as
short
as
too,
as
yeah.
Individual, but he was also part of my favorite Heat team ever. So, another guy that we just gotta give a shout to, James Posey. We talked about Shane Battier and Keith Askins. Posey is another in that line, right? If the going through that graduate school, and my man Antoine Walker has no business being in top five, but I just got to give a shout out to Antoine Walker.
Yeah, to me, he always feels like more of a power forward player. But yeah, you're right. I mean, he did play the three here. And who can forget three-time NBA champion James Jones? I mean, another guy we had to leave off the list. I mean, local product out of American high school. He was there before the Brig 3 era. He also came to the University of Miami. I mean, he was – he was a great role player, and you know, not a bad guy. I think a lot of people disparage him because basically all he can do is shoot threes. But I mean, I've never seen anybody have more success with 4-point plays than James Jones, and he's got three
free throws before the camera can even get to the free throw line.
Yes.
Which is my favorite thing. It's like, okay, James Jones, he got fouled, but, you know, like, he never played. So, like, when he did get fouled, broadcast crews weren't, used to the fact that he gets the ball and immediately shoots it, like, which is right. Steph Curry quickness. And so they'd be like, oh, wait, his free throws are done. He got 2 more points. Okay, we're going on. And it's like the camera just – I don't think I've ever seen a James Jones free throw. I think you just hear about them. You just know that they happen.
Yeah, you see him reflected on the scoreboard, which is all that really matters, and that's his exactly. lasting impact here in Miami.
And I guess worth noting, because if you go online, you look at some top five small forward rankings, Billy Owens gets thrown in there a lot just because of his yes. stats. He spent, what, a year and a half in Miami? But
that was a weird one, because I think he was part of the – or he was like a precursor to the Hardaway trade. I don't know if he was included in the same trade or not, but he was at one point Miami –
like, yeah, for the full year, yeah, his stats were great, but you know, it's just like, you know, he played 1 year. It's I can't put him.
It's hard to include him in the list, but yeah, I don't know if you remember seeing him play. You probably never saw him play, right? He was a guy who was really weird because he was kind of like soft, you know, like in the word, you know, when you have a team with a guy like, you know, a consummate workout freak like Alonzo Mourning, Billy Owens was the exact opposite, but he was also a guy who was like 6'9" and could do everything. Like, you're talking about versatility. This was a guy who just never tapped into his potential. He could run the fast break. He could dribble really well. He was a hell of a passer, pretty good shooter, but he just never got it together. I don't know what it was. And eventually he got traded to, you know, they found out that he wasn't going to be a serviceable part of this team moving forward. So they shipped him out to Sacramento for Walt Williams, the Wizard, which is I don't know if you remember Walt Williams. He had his socks all the way up to his knees. That's the thing I remember about Walt Williams the most.
That's a look we need to bring back. Okay, so absolutely. To recap, Lou Aldang, we both had at 5. I had Shane yes. Battier at my 4. You had Keith Askins at 4. We both have Jamal Mashburn at 3. We're going to move on to number 2. Who you got?
I think it's the same as yours, Glenn Rice.
I had Money. I'm just kidding. I had Glenn Rice, yeah.
yeah, I think, you know, Glenn Rice – you know, I've seen him described as Miami's first superstar, but I think that's kind of unfair because I think he really achieved success beyond it. I think, like, the knock on Glenn, if anything, was that, you know, we didn't have a lot of postseason success, but I don't think that was necessarily his fault. I think he was as good as he could have been for those teams that lacked a lot of identity during the pre-Riley era. And that's also one of the things that I'll never forgive Riley for, because I loved watching Glenn Rice so much. I thought he was so smooth as a shooter and he was just so great and everything else. And, you know, I really enjoyed watching him with Miami for, you know, a season or two when I really started watching basketball and he was still with Miami. And then he got traded immediately to, you know, Charlotte for Alonzo Mourning. And I really resented it. You know, I knew that Alonzo was the same kind of player that Riley always wanted at center, the way he had Ewing and Kareem and all these others. But to get rid of a guy who was, you know, again, the biggest name on the team, I really thought that was a mistake. But, you know, I think it wound up paying off later on. But Riley, I mean, Rice was just, what can he say about it? I mean, I actually got a chance to see him in his last season. No, I'm sorry. I think it was actually he had already gotten traded to Charlotte. And I saw him in warmups before. And, you know, I've seen Steph Curry warm up. I've seen a bunch of other, you know, notable shooters warm up close over the last season. And to me, Rice was just so fluid. Like, he was just at 6'8", and a big 240 pounds. I mean, he was just really, really smooth as a shooter. He would catch it and release it in one fluid motion. And he just knocked down, I think at one point he had knocked down like 17 in a row. I remember being captivated by a guy who could shoot so well at his size. And one more anecdote that I'll add to him. He was already towards the tail end of his career. And one night I was hanging around with a buddy of mine in Coconut Grove, coming out of a bar after a few too many pitchers. And who would I bump into but Glenn Rice and his ex-wife, Christina, who was so upset that my drunken ass stumbled over to Glenn, saying nothing but great things about him and his career in Miami and how he had to rejoin Miami.
And he didn't.
What was that?
And he didn't, right?
No, he didn't. Unfortunately not.
He didn't have the sway. That's a great story. I don't know what to follow it up with, but it just, you know, you mentioned just a terrifically natural scorer. dropped a guy that just like dropped 30 points like routinely, just, you know, and he didn't play for a lot of great Heat teams, but just, you know, you can go back and look at his stats and you're just like, Jesus, like this guy just scored in bunches. I mean, he dropped 56 points against the Magic in 1995, and I think he missed like four shots or something. Like, it was just insane. But for, you know, you mentioned he is often talked about as the original or the first Heat superstar.
Right.
If you were going to write a book on Miami eventually becoming a basketball town, which it is, if you were going to write that book, the first chapter is starting with Glenn Rice. Like, not only were his stats good and did he have the productivity, but like you said, he scored in such a interesting, fun way to watch. I mean, he was so aesthetically pleasing. And, you know, you mentioned his size and the way he's able to shoot from outside. You know, just very Tracy McGrady-esque in that way. And you know, to get eyes away from the Miami Dolphins and Miami Hurricanes shifted towards this new thing happening in the Miami Heat, because he was drafted in their second year. He joined the team in 1989. To get those eyes looking towards the Miami Heat, that was huge, you know, and that was so big for the Heat organization. And a lot of times, I think, you know, if you were to want to draw a string through this whole series that we're doing, is just how much success the Heat have had in such a short period of time.
Right.
That all starts with Glenn Rice. And, you know, I don't know how much of that you could actually attribute to him. It's not like he came back and was the general manager and drafted Dwayne Wade and did all these things, but, I mean, the book starts with Glenn Rice, and I think that's, you know, when we talk about the most important guys in Heat history, I mean, the only way that you can be better than Glenn Rice is to win multiple championships and be an all-time great, which is what LeBron James is.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good segue, but one last point there on Rice is, you know, without him being as good as he was, Riley can't pull the trigger on that trade for Alonzo Mourning, which really started the whole Riley era that we've, you know, come to appreciate in our current situation, but
that's a good point. He was the capital that the Heat needed to launch themselves into
right
culture.
And I mean, he enjoyed all-star success there. He won a title with the Lakers eventually. You know, his career kind of petered out. He played for Houston, the Clippers, and the Knicks, and all these other teams, you know, one or two seasons with each. It wasn't ever quite the same player, just because his athleticism and his knees were shot at that point, but still was a really capable shooter, and I think I'll always remember him fondly here. And I'm sure his wife won't remember me as fondly, but that's a whole other story. To continue your segue, I think, yes, the number one player, an obvious choice here, but not so obvious for me. I think, you know, LeBron James, I think a lot of people tend to think of him as the best small forward, one of the best small forwards in NBA history. But I had a difficult choice making him my number one, because I think, you know, he played so much time at the power forward position. And so I wasn't quite sure whether or not to include him in that list. But I think ultimately, the way that you mentioned, you know, that Battier was able to kind of make the positions really seem fluid and interchangeable, I think ultimately I felt more comfortable just leaving him at small forward. But what can you say about LeBron? That,
I mean, I'm with you, right? Like, for me, LeBron played power forward. You know,
right.
when the Heat won championships and they were at the best, he was the power forward. And Chris Bosh was the center. And Shane Battier was basically the three. But, you know,
at least offensively, right? That's the whole thing. Right. Offensively, that's the way it worked out. Defensively, they would shift off, which
depending
is what you alluded to.
Right,
exactly.
But it was, for me, I was like, okay, when LeBron is in the Hall of Fame, the Basketball Hall of Fame, he's going to be listed as small forward. And he's going to be remembered as small forward. So I just threw him at small forward. He's a small forward that played power forward. So I don't know. I'm with you. It's like it makes sense, but it doesn't make sense. But
Sure. Either
way, we have him as our number one.
Complicated legacy here in Miami, I guess. It's probably worth getting into. You know, I think, you know, a four-year stint that meant so much and ended so rockily, but was such a significant part of this team and this franchise's history. I think ultimately people probably still appreciate it. I know there are a lot of people who really dislike LeBron still. I think, you know, even members of my family who will root against the Cavaliers, they'd even root for him against, you know, if he was part of the men's Olympic team in 2020, they'd root for another country to take gold over the U.S. just because they wanted
strong.
Yes, they are. And I'm sure some of our listeners probably are, you know, card-carrying members of Team Petty. But, I started off that way. I was really pissed off, really upset, really shocked, as much as, you know, most people were. And then eventually just kind of move on. And, you know, I think that the complicated part of it was how it ended. There's no right way of doing it, unfortunately. He had to negotiate with Dan Gilbert and to see if that team was some one that he wanted to come back to or could, you know, theoretically come back to. He left as a free agent. He employed his right as an employee, as a human being who works in the NBA. And, you know, to that, you can't hold it against him. But let's remember the 4 years that he was here, where he was arguably the best player in the game. I think, you know, pretty handily, he won the MVP twice, should have won it a third time, carried those teams as good as they were to the finals four times. I mean, he was a really, really, really great player. And I think we should ignore the noise and everything that came afterwards and just focus on those 4 years and how good he was here in Miami.
I mean, just to continue the metaphor about that book about Miami becoming a basketball town, the story ends with LeBron James. You know, it's just the way that he was able to electrify and then magnify basketball in Miami. I mean, right. It went from it being like almost a cult following, I felt like, you know, growing up with the Heat, where it's like if the Heat were your favorite South Florida team, you were kind of weird, to where... Or, you know, you were in the minority, at least.
For sure.
To where, you know, when LeBron came and made it such a show and made it so important, it put the Heat on a national stage up there with the Lakers and the Celtics and just, like, the great teams, you know, the Bulls. Yeah. Just like LeBron came into Miami and turned it into a major market for really the first time. And
well, I remember when Shaquille O'Neal came in 2005 – But you're right, though. I think, you know, they put Miami on the map nationally, I think, in 2005. And sure, true enough, you know, 2 years later, they won a title. But nothing at the same level as this Heat Big Three era. At a time when social media was available, when it wasn't during Shaq's era, when people could break down and digest everything ad nauseum and attack everything and anything that you do, this was a completely different animal. And I think this was far, far, far bigger in scope than anything that happened during the Shaq era.
As you're talking, I'm thinking, like, it was really the first big three. You know, we've had super teams in the past plenty of times. Mm. It was really the first big three of the social media era.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Which completely changed how we talked about it and thought about it and watched it and everything like that. And I remember hopping onto a radio show afterwards, and people were asking me, like, what does it feel like that after LeBron left, after he re-signed with Cleveland a couple years ago, I hopped onto a radio show, and they said, what does this feel like? You know, what does this feel like for Heat fans? And the way I always thought about it was, you know, it's like you're waking up from a four-year frat party, and you're just like, what the hell just happened? Because it just kicked off with smoke machines and TV specials and not one, not two, not threes and parties and just like, and like all of a sudden it went from like one camera to 17 on everything. And it was just insane. And for 4 years, it was just like every game was micro analyzed and just like, it's not just basketball, but his relationship with his teammates, like Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh and how it happened in the first place. And
right.
It was such a circus, you know, a media circus, for lack of a better term, for four straight years, and it was always that way. Even when it was the off season, it was just always that way. It was nonstop, and it was, you know, the media got boosted. I mean, we've seen so many local media people get national gigs from that. I mean, it transformed everything about South Florida media and basketball and sports in general. And then all of a sudden, with one Sports Illustrated letter, it's gone. And you just wake up and you're like, holy shit, what just happened? Like, and to me, that's how it always felt for me. And so I don't think that those 4 years you can replace or repeat in any way. It was so novel and interesting and different, and is just like by far the best four-year stretch in Miami Heat history. And that's because LeBron. You know, there's no other way to put it, you know.
Now that he's won a title with the Cavaliers, what's your feeling on how these 4 years will be viewed in terms of his overall legacy and his career? Because I think they become a minor footnote, and that's a sad thing, because he was arguably at his best during that 4-year stretch. And I think that's a lot of the resentment any Cavaliers fans may still have, which has probably been erased due to the title. But any issues they may have had with LeBron were that it was at the point in time when he was at his physical peak, he was best. From now, this point forward, as great as he's been over the last two seasons where he's been in Cleveland, he's probably going to start to degrade a little bit just because of age and overall physical health. But that 4-year stretch where he won the MVP twice and likely should have won it a third year.
Absolutely. Derrick Rose did not deserve that.
Absolutely. We've talked about it before, but that was a sham. It was, lingering hatred about the whole decision in that first year of the Big Three era. But LeBron was far better individually as a player than Derrick Rose was and ever will be. But that's a whole other podcast.
To answer your question, I think the way that LeBron even put it, that it was he never went to college, but those 4 years in Miami were like his college education.
Yeah,
I think that's going to be the way that we view it. Certainly the Cavalier, his championship with the Cavaliers and that block, against Andre Iguodala, that's like his signature moment and his signature play. It's a signature achievement and signature play of his career. But he could very well win more championships. His peak has been so long. I mean, I tweeted out the other day. I mean, it's amazing thinking about LeBron. Since his second year in the league, he's been the best player in the NBA. And it's just an insane thing to think about, whether or not maybe not the best, but like top three. I mean, I think he was the best, but you can argue like top three, I mean, easily for 12, 13 straight years. It's insane.
I think it's fair.
And I don't know if he's going to degrade. I mean, I haven't seen it yet, and I'll believe it when I see it. But even so, like, those 4 years in Miami encapsulate the peak of his peak. You know what I mean? And that's, no matter how many more championships he wins in Cleveland,
mm-hmm.
he will always be able to claim LeBron's absolute most powerful form, which is insane. I mean, he shot like 80% from the field that 1 year. I mean, it was insane. Like, it's the way that he was able to be efficient, I think, was just eye-popping. I mean, the numbers were just ridiculous, but the way he did it efficiently was just in so stark a contrast to guys like Kobe Bryant, who was the all-time great before LeBron, and, it just changed the way a lot of people thought about basketball and viewed efficiency as something that was super important, I thought. And I guess just, when you look back on it and you're looking at the story of LeBron James, I think a lot of people will understand that he probably couldn't have done what he just did in Cleveland if it were not for if it wasn't for his time in Miami.
Yeah, I mean, I think that says it best, to be honest with you. I think, he was a great player, transformative, generational. I mean, there's so many superlatives and all of them are applicable. And while there's still some people out there in the the Heat fan base that might be upset with him, I think you still have to appreciate the kind of person he is on the court, even if you don't necessarily like who he is off of it. And during the 4 years that he was here, he was sensational, and he made this team immensely fun to watch. There was never a moment where you didn't think that they could win it. Any loss was a shock to you. I'll never forget that win streak that we talked about with Battier before, and the fact that they were at one point down, I want to say 20-something points to the Cavaliers, and they wound up coming back. I mean, that was just an amazing performance there. And
I was at work, and I was watching that game on the ESPN's game tracker on my phone.
Yeah.
I was working a college job where I basically had to move chairs around the student union. It was
fun.
Yeah, great job. But, I had some downtime, and I just didn't have it. I don't have a TV or anything. I'm just watching, and I'm like, oh, shit, we're done. Then all of a sudden, I check in like 2 minutes. I was like, "Oh my god!" And then you check in another minute or two, and you're like, "What the hell's going on? We're only down now. We're down 10." And you're just like, and then me and a buddy at work are just watching this and just like watching the points kind of tick down until the Heat eventually won. And I was just like, "Holy crap! What just happened?" I just remember like rushing home as soon as work was over to watch SportsCenter and see what happened. And I was just like blown away. But yeah, great moments. I mean, in general. So yeah, LeBron to me, it's to anybody, I think, is just by far the number one. I think, if you're going to miss anything about LeBron, it's just, like you said, watching him play was just sensational. All right.
Yep.
Well, I think that's all we got for today. And whether you're listening on iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher, thank you for listening. You can get in touch with the show on Twitter at LockedOnHeat or by email, where you can send us mailbag questions, inquire about advertising, or just say hi. That's LockedOnHeat@gmail.com. A big thanks to SeatGeek for sponsoring the show today, and thanks to David for joining me.
Thank you, Wes.
Okay, we'll catch you next time.
Ace is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.